A very good evening to you. Welcome to the programme. 3 minutes past six on this beautiful Thursday evening. It is glorious in Dublin. I'm conscious it might not be glorious everywhere around the country, but we hope wherever it is you join us from, the sun is shining and you can stay with us over the course of the next 54 minutes or so. Plenty of good sporting chat to come between now and 7 o'clock. We've got a British and Irish Lions squad to analyse. We've got American sport to chat about in the company of Shep. And we've loads of soccer stuff as well in the company of Keith Tracy, who'll be with us towards the end of the programme. Hope you can stay with us. Our number across various platforms, 51552. Or you can find us across social media at GameOn2FM.
This is
2FM's
Game On.
It certainly is. Bernard Jackman is with me in studio to get things up and running. How are you?
Good, thanks, yeah. Glad to have the Lions team squad selected.
Something to chat about. Yeah. You know, you measure your career in various ways. So like your first time you maybe get play for your club at senior level, and you might get an old junior interprovincial call-up or a national cap or medals. Do you have your medals on display?
No.
Hidden away?
Yeah.
Okay. One of my measures is I'm about to be on air for the second time that a Pope is revealed. And I'm only, you know, listen, a man of my age. So there has been white smoke at the Vatican. And if there's news to bring you, we will bring it to you between now and 7 o'clock. But we're going to start with rugby. 38-man Irish squad. 38-man Lions squad, largely Irish weighted. 15 players, a record Irish contingent. Dan Sheehan, Ronan Kelleher, Andrew Porter, Tyke Furlong, Joe McCarthy, James Ryan, Jack Conan, Josh Van der Fleer, Jemison Gibson-Park, Gary Ringrose, James Lowe and Hugo Keenan, all making the cut from a Leinster perspective. 12 of those, Bundy Aki and Mac Hansen from Connacht, Tyke Byrne, the only Munster player involved, no Ulster contingent. Ireland absolutely dominating this. There's an awful lot to analyse. Mauro Itoje named captain, as we would have expected. What stands out for you?
I think the fade he has in those Irish players, because obviously the temptation would be with Ireland having a quiet of Six Nations, finishing third. Leinster at the weekend, obviously coming up short again. He hasn't batted an eyelid. He's just shown trust and faith in players that have done incredible jobs for him, and I think the players will be very grateful for that, and now they'll hopefully repay it for him come June, July. Because if the Lions tour wasn't to go well, given the fact that there's so many Irish coaches, so many Irish backroom staff, and so many Irish players, it will become quite tricky for Andy Farrell. But as I said, he's always been someone who, even his coaching staff, it's by and large people he's worked with before. Mm. He's big on that, big on knowing people, knowing their character. I think Doris, my understanding was Doris was going to be captain, so particularly cruel for him the injury he got the weekend. But it probably opened up Jack Conan to come in, and like Keller, you know, Ronan Kelleher probably would have been a little bit anxious, obviously, because he's not getting starts for Leinster or Ireland, but he was British and Irish Lion last time. Phenomenal player, so he gets to play. And I think for me it was Gary Ringrose, James Ryan, and Josh Van der Fleer, who I really was happy to see them get picked, because if they didn't get picked for this tour, you'd be saying that, you know, three phenomenal players weren't going to be British and Irish Lions, and now they've ticked that box. So yeah, big call. Obviously Robbie Henshaw is probably the most unlucky to lose out. Again, another former British and Irish Lion, but just probably a quiet game on Saturday may have been enough to. And also, to be fair, it's the competition. I think centres is, you know, obviously he's got two centres from his own country, Bundy and Gary Ringrose, but obviously Sione Tupulotu and Hugh Jones are a formidable pair as well. And then you've got players like Daly who can play 13 or in the outside back. So, yeah, it's Robbie's probably the most unlucky.
Ireland aside, like we're going to hear from Josh Van der Fleer in a couple of minutes' time. Ireland aside, like there's a couple of what on the face of it look to be brave calls, like Henry Pollock brought in at the age that he's at.
No, that's not a brave call. It's a brave call to where he was 2 or 3 months ago, but I think class recognises class, and I think I've been speaking to some players who've been playing against him, and they say he's just out of this world. And I think he's going to be a starter for the Lions. I think that's how good he is. And I think we saw a glimpse of it on Saturday in the Viva. Someone who obviously had a very, very limited time in the Six Nations, but I don't think Farrell would have questioned that choice when he saw him up close.
The other two that I was going to throw at you, like Finn Smith, obviously massive. Like, is it too tabloid to say there was a battle of two potential tens at the Aviva Stadium last weekend, and he's the one who's won out?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think he to come to the Viva, to be on the back foot for a lot of the game and to put together the performance he did. He's just so calm. I mean, let's not forget, the other 10 that's been picked, apart from Finn Russell, is Marcus Smith. And effectively, Finn Smith
he was the next player I was going to come
no,
to.
No, but Finn Smith has pushed him to being a sub or to be playing fullback. They think a lot of him. They think a lot of Sam as well, to be fair. But probably this Lions tour has come a year too soon for him, I'd say, in terms of what he needs to do in his development. But Finn Smith is quality. And then Marcus Smith is a really good option as your third 10, because obviously on the bench he covers 10 or fullback, and he also can change the game. He's a very exciting player. So I like the three 10s that he's brought.
Maro Itoje named captain. It was interesting. Eddie Jones was on Talk Sport this morning, who have been broadcasting about this over the course of the day. It's like what Sky News and Sky Sports do to soccer, Talk Sport we're doing to rugby today. He was very critical of Itoje as a captaincy option, saying he didn't think he had the skill set that was required to bring a group of players together. And it was interesting to hear an English perspective on the captaincy, saying, well, Caelan Dorris being injured has probably done Andy Farrell a favour in the grand scheme, that one other significant Irish appointment was going to make it difficult to gel. Does that hold water?
Well, I think Dorris has a way with people, so I think he would have been able to manage that. But I think from a fans or a non-Irish media point of view, it may have looked a step too far. You know, you've got such an Irish backroom team, and then you're making your captain Irish, and a lot of your players are Irish. I think that injury's probably worked out in favour. I think Maro Itoje has, I think probably the Maro Itoje that Eddie coached may have not been the ideal captain, but I think you saw in this year Six Nations where, you know, they took the captaincy off Jamie George, they gave it to Maro, and I thought he led England in a very impressive manner, and they were lucky not to win the Six Nations. And the beauty of Maro Itoje is this is his third British and Irish Lions tour. The first time he went, he was the youngest, so he knows what it's like to be that young gun. And he's been there, done that. That was going to be the challenge for Caelan, not being a former Lion, is how he understands how previous captains have gelled. Now, I think he would have been able to do it, but I actually think not having an Irish captain is actually will turn out to be a bonus for Farrell long term.
So to explain, we're going to hear from Josh van der Fleer. To explain how all this works, and you can contradict me, but my understanding is the players are written to and are asked, are you available if selected? And the players either opt in or opt out. And then you don't find out, with the exception of the captain,
Until it's live. Yeah.
So across, like, and there's some brilliant social media footage of, I think the Scarlets are on, or no, Ospreys are on a plane to South Africa, Jack Morgan found out on the plane, and different things. So it's big news for the players. It's done in alphabetical order, which is agony for some. Jack Conan got off easy. Bundy got off easy with the alphabetical thing. But one man who had to wait, as has been mentioned, to be confirmed for his first Lions tour is Josh van der Fleer. We had the opportunity to chat to him. He was kind enough to take a call a couple of minutes ago. So what is the sensation like when you're sitting down in front of your television, your name is called out, and the realisation hits, I'm going to be a British and Irish Lion?
Feels strange to hear it, really. Hard to get my head around, to be honest. Finished training and had kind of obviously focused on training and trying not to think about it too much. But yeah, it's incredibly special. My phone's been hopping, obviously a lot of family and friends texting. And then obviously I think what's really special is you see what it means to your family and everything. But even having past coaches, people who coached me in Wicklow Rugby Club and in Wesley, my school, in UCD, and in Leinster then as well. So it's kind of nice for what it means to everyone else as well. But yeah, I'm very delighted with myself. Yeah, very happy.
I was listening to it on radio this afternoon from TalkSport, and they were comparing it to when, say, a soccer squad is announced for a major tournament and the leaks start to emerge. But the reality around this is you have to endure the agony of hearing every forward's name called out before it gets down to V. Like, you make yourself available for the tour, but you don't know you're going on the tour until Ian Evans calls your name out.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it was... I actually spoke to Jack Conan this morning because he'd obviously been selected last time. And I was like, because with Ireland, you kind of get an email just before it comes out. So you kind of have an idea then before teams are announced. Whereas he was like, nope, you got to watch it and you got to wait and see if your name comes up. So yeah, it was tough having, I've never really been too bothered by being the last in the alphabet normally. but this time around, it was quite stressful, especially when you see all the other back rows popping up and you're kind of thinking there can't be that many back rows left for this squad. So yeah, absolutely. It was obviously a small, I tried to be as relaxed as I could, but it was obviously still a little stressful watching.
Who did you watch it with?
We finished training and we had lunch, and lunch was going to coincide with when the announcement was. So most of us, I think a good few lads did it. I just got my lunch to take away and went straight home, watched it on my own. But I had my wife, Sophie, on FaceTime. So she was in work. She was watching it in work, and I was kind of talking to her on FaceTime throughout it. Though, that was a very nice moment.
Put it into context for people who, like, listen, the Lions will have dissenting people who will say, oh, listen, it's about marketing, it's about this, it's about that. From a rugby player's perspective, like, this is Everest. This is the highest honour that you can achieve. And it's something presumably you work towards, but it's something you never expect perhaps to come your way.
Absolutely. It's, as you said, it's very much a pinnacle in rugby. It's obviously, I don't think anything, it's so different to being picked for your country. I think that's a complete, it's kind of separate. It's obviously an unbelievable honour to play for your country. But I think to be selected, including all the other nations that are involved in it, it's pretty special. But I suppose it's also one of those things, because it's every 4 years, it's not something that you can kind of play well for a year and you kind of get on. It's got a full right for you. A lot of people just don't, you kind of need a bit of luck or whatever it is along the way as well to get to be in form in the right time and to get picked. So it's obviously a long wait for anyone who's obviously been striving to get here, but very, very happy to be a part of it.
What has the build up to this week been like? Because presumably everywhere you have gone, say around post Six Nations time or in the run up to this, everyone is talking to you about the potential to be a Lion.
Yeah, it can definitely, I suppose earlier in the season I was kind of thinking about it, and it's like I'm 32, I just turned 32 last week, so I'm like, I could play till I'm 36, but I suppose there wouldn't be many 36-year-olds to be in the contention for Lions. So I'm kind of thinking that way. I was like, this is very much not many chances left to get on a Lions tour. And I kind of, earlier on the season, I just tried to park it. I decided it's kind of how I'd approach the game and try to approach the game in general, any matches week to week. But I was like, I'll try my hardest. I'll play as well as I can for Leinster and hopefully with Ireland then, and just kind of forget about it after that, and if it happens, it happens. That was kind of how I dealt with it anyway, and just tried not to think about it. I've completely avoided watching any rugby on TV, any like rugby shows or anything on social media. I've basically blocked off everything to do with rugby I've always done that, but particularly at the moment, obviously, because it's so topical, you just don't want to be thinking about it, especially with obviously having big games going on in Leinster and everything. There's a lot else going on, so that's kind of how I dealt with it anyway, because it can definitely get overwhelming if you obsess yourself thinking over it, but that's kind of my process for dealing with it anyway.
I don't want to get into it. It's been a difficult week. This is such a great day for Irish rugby, a record number of Irish players heading off on the tour, and like very special from a Leinster perspective as well, that so many of these guys that you soldier with day in, day out are heading off on a tour. And like the ones that are jumping out for me, like just say like yourself, Gary Ringrose, you know, to be selected after all that you've achieved to head off on your first Lions tour, like it's... these are the days that you have to force yourself to savour.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so happy for the lads. I remember, like, I've watched these obviously throughout the years, and even when I was younger, you watch the squad being named and you're kind of like, oh, I like that player, that's a good player, happy to see them, all these kind of things. But I think when you know them as, when you know the lads as friends and you see how hard they all work, the effort they put in, how much it means to their family going to support every game, and you see these lads, like Gary as an example, obviously, you're like just as happy for them as a person as you are for however much you think they deserve it as a rugby player. You kind of, it's great to see them deserve it as a person as well. It's nice.
Yeah, and then the flip side of that is, I don't think there's anyone who's watched rugby over the last 12 months whose heart can't go out to Caelan Doris, because he has been such an epic player for Ireland and such a brilliant leader for the national side, that it kind of reminds you of the cruel side of the sport, that he's going to miss out on this as a result of an injury.
Yeah, absolutely. It's devastating for him. Yeah, I know Andrew Porter was kind of in a similar situation last Lions tour. He ended up missing out on it. It's tough. It's a cruel part of the sport, to be honest. Caelan's a an unbelievable fella. In fairness to him, he's brought a huge amount of positivity to Leinster this week. He's been full of energy and great to be around. And it's but it must be obviously so tough for him on a personal level to not be eligible for injury. So yeah, it's very tough to see for him.
So just to finish, I presume having been contacted by everyone today, now you're going to be bombarded with details of how people get on the flights, and I presume half the family are going to head to Australia now for their summer holidays.
I'd say, well, my parents don't really miss many matches, and I think, I suppose, an excuse to go to Australia is pretty it's hard to turn down, I suppose. But yeah, I'm sure they will. I've pretty much had my phone off. A friend of mine popped over after the announcement. I was kind of chatting with him for a while, and I have pretty much had my phone off for the last couple of hours. So yeah, I'm sure there'll be a lot of logistics to go through and stuff, but I'll just try to process the emotions for the moment, I think, and then sort that out later on.
And then put it all to one side and finish out the URC season before worrying about any of that. Josh, I'm delighted for you on a personal level. It's great to see fellas who soldiered for so long with a smile on their face achieve what it is that they've wanted to achieve for so long. So I'm delighted for you. I wish you well, and thanks so much on a fairly hectic day for taking the time to chat to us.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate that. Thank you.
That's Josh van der Fleer chatting shortly before we came on air. I know the Lions has changed over the years, and it's now a monster machine. Like, people paying 60 quid a go to be in there for the squad announcement today. But from a player's perspective, it is the pinnacle. And like, we can't take away the fact that there's 15 Irish players today who in some cases are going to fulfill a career ambition.
Oh, 100%. It's probably one of the biggest goals, even young aspiring players have, is to play for your country and then to play for the British and Irish Lions. And it's as Josh says there, I mean, it can be the highlight of your career. Obviously, you would hope that they would go and do things in World Cups, and Grand Slams are amazing as well. But this is a special opportunity to make friends. And I know that when you have been in a line and you play against the Welsh and the Scots and the English over the following years, you play against them with your clubs, there's always a special camaraderie off the field as well. And I think with Farrell, I think what's one of Farrell's greatest strengths is his ability to bring people together. So they'll have a phenomenal tour. Australia's obviously a brilliant place to tour. The last Lions tour in South Africa was very difficult because of COVID. Like, so this is going to be an amazing tour. There's going to be a huge fan base down there, and I hope now that those 38 got picked today get there safe and sound to go travel, because unfortunately we've seen nearly every tour I think someone high profile has got injured in the playoffs or the Champions Cup final, and that's the risk of the game.
I think there was 8 players called up on the last tour. Like, Warren Gatland got criticised, was it the last tour or the tour before, where
New Zealand,
Welsh lads, like I know it's disingenuous to say there'll be a flood of fellas who didn't make the squad who'll be on the phone to travel agents looking to book holidays in New Zealand in the hope that they can make a short hop to Australia should they be injured. Like, it's probably a slightly smaller squad than people expected. And the other one that's interesting is, has he made a constructive decision not to call his son up today, potentially ahead of calling him up? Owen Farrell is such a multifaceted player, like we've talked about earlier on, that he'd be an ideal guy to bring into a squad if you lose a 10, if you lose a centre, if you even potentially lose a fullback.
Yeah, I've no doubt players are going to be called out. Some of them may be on tour, some of the Irish lads may be on tour in Georgia or Portugal. I think Owen Farrell would have a cracking chance of being called up late, to be honest. I think especially if you got an injury to, particularly a 10, and you look at, Finn Smith has been incredible, but someone like Owen Farrell, he has massive respect from all the English players. Obviously, his time has been captain there, but also the rest of the players. Like, he is someone that everyone respects. So there will be players called up for sure. But I think Farrell will be one of the first ones that they'd look at if it was a back injured.
Just to finish, 12 months ago, we'd have really worried about this tour because Australia was in disarray. Like, the side stories from an Irish perspective, Farrell against Schmidt and David Nusafora, part of the backroom staff, against Schmidt and all that sort of stuff. And Les Kiss now will probably have a role to play as well. Like, all that stuff is going to make a lot of noise. But in a purely rugby sense, Australia are in a much stronger position than they are. And all of this talk, well, than they were, it's all relative. But like, are we veering away from talking about a 3-test whitewash? And like, how good a tour do you expect it to be in a sporting context?
No, I think it's going to be top level. I think Joe Schmidt has done a brilliant job already, and there's more to come. You look at the Australian franchises, how much they've improved. He can pick players based in Japan. He can pick Will Skelton based in La Rochelle. And those players will see this as the pinnacle of their career. To win a series against the British and Irish Lions on home soil is massive for the Springboks, massive for the Wallabies or the All Blacks. And this is going to be a humdinger. And also, like, I think it's great that England are back strong, and obviously they cost us a place in the Six Nations. They demoted us to third, but I think they've got some really good young players. We saw Tommy Freeman at the weekend. We spoke about Pollock already, and then you have Captain Atoje, but also you know, you've got some like Josh Van der Fleer. Like, what a competitive position he's in with likes of Ben Earl, with likes of Tom Curry that he's competing with, and Pollock. Ty Byrne may end up being a six. When you look at the back rows they've picked, there's no real lineup option, and he went for Scott Cummings, which he probably went for one back row less than we may have expected him to, and one second row more. So you may see Ty Byrne being deployed as a line option at six.
Okay, before I let you go, we've the penultimate round of regular season URC games this weekend. Obviously, Leinster sitting top of the table. Munster 9th, Ulster 12th, Connacht 14th. Like, do we need to accept, like, Munster, talk about a must-win game in the derby against Connacht at the weekend. Like, Leinster aside, everyone looks to have left it too late to really push for those top 8 places. And
no, Munster don't have a chance.
Okay,
but there's
no margin for error.
No, one will knock each other out tomorrow. So this is huge pressure on Munster. I don't think Munster have ever missed out on Europe. There's obviously pressure on Ulster as well, but I think there's less expectations around Ulster this year. You would expect it's Pete and Killer and all those lads. It's their last game in Limerick. Obviously, they're playing Cork the week after. But Munster will be seeding from that defeat to Cardiff, and you would expect a big crowd, big reaction tomorrow night.
To finish, with the expectation that's on them, and I know you were at the Aviva last weekend, would the URC be a mere consolation to Leinster fans and Leinster players at this stage, or do we need to be a bit more magnanimous and say silverware is silverware? They've not won anything for three seasons.
I think it's non-negotiable that they win it, yeah, for them as, yeah, a squad. And that may help them get over the jitters that they've shown consistently the last 3 or 4 years in knockout rugby. But I still think at the end of the season, even with a URC, given the injuries that Toulouse suffered, given the fact they were home in the semi-final, they will definitely see it as a failure this year. Like, you can't have 12 players in British and Irish Lions and then add Slimani, add Jordy Barrett, add Orgy Snyman, yeah, and not be in finals.
Okay, so yeah, pressure over the coming weeks. Bernard, thank you very much for being with us as always. I know you're heavily invested in the papal election, so to confirm, Robert Francis Prevost, who is a Chicago Cardinal, has been elected. I mean, he's a Cubs fan, I'm told. He has been elected as the new Pope. He's currently on the balcony in St. Peter's addressing the masses, and he has taken the name Pope Leo. So he is Pope Leo XIV. And with that, I maintain my established tradition of now two popes in a row having the opportunity to announce it on 2FM. So listen, these are the things that you'll remember. That's my reeling in the ears moment, Bernard. Anyway, listen, thanks to you for being with us. We're going to go to the States and talk to Shep about sport, not necessarily about the Pope, but no doubt that'll come up in conversation as well. And Keith Tracy will be with us before 7 o'clock to chat soccer. All of that still to come. Stay with us.
RTE 2FM. Game on.
Eye on America.
And you're welcome back to the programme. We're going to go to the States. Shep is with us. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, Damien. How you doing, buddy?
Not too bad. Now, you and I, over the years, we've gone off on the mother and father of tangents on this slot in our many years of chatting about various things, but I never thought I'd launch into great day for America with the new Pope being elected.
I mean, live, local, and late breaking. That's what we call this, right, Damien? Yeah, so they just announced the first ever American Pope. So, you know, shout out to the conclave, you know, for doing the hard work behind the scenes. Most importantly, Damien, he is a Chicago Cubs fan. And I think really, it's definitely going to be our year this year. There's no way, you know, Otani or the Dodgers or anybody could stand in the way when we've got, you know, the Vatican on our side.
Okay, well, listen, he's obviously got the contacts, so we will wait and see. We have that now on the login machine that records all of these outputs, so we'll roll this back in a couple of years' time and see if that tends to be the case. Now, will we have the audacity to actually talk about sport on a sports program?
Yeah, sure, every once in a while.
Yeah, listen, I suppose with the week that's in it, I'll talk to you about Steph Curry and injury issues in a minute, but NFL, it's obviously a quiet enough time of the week. All the focus is on the draft, the analysing of the draft, who did well, who did badly, and like, listen, there's always a couple of bolters along the way, somebody who's ranked so far down it that you think they're inconsequential who will go on to become a big star. What should we keep an eye out for?
Well, it's so funny, you know, the draft, you know, the grading stuff. It's like, who got an A or who got a C? Who knows? You won't know for, I mean, you're lucky if you know something, you know, after the first year. I think you have to look at, you know, not a ton of teams are making changes at quarterbacks. We kind of talked about this last week. And, you know, the whole Shador Sanders thing's just kind of overrode everything. I do think, you know, one of the items we're going to talk about with George Pickens, you know, the Cowboys, as always, do Cowboy things. And, you know, Jerry Jones likes big, fast receivers and, you know, flashy offense and doesn't really like to address a lot of the other issues on defense. And they'll continue to, you know, have a, you know, 500 record. They traded for George Pickens from the Pittsburgh Steelers. And so, you know, they get Dak Prescott back. And if he's healthy and pairing him up with CeeDee Lamb, who's one of the best receivers in the NFL, and, you know, you've got Pickens. And, you know, again, they'll have another formidable offense. But that's usually not the issue that the Cowboys have. So, you know, we'll just see how they kind of handle things. And you look on the other side of that trade, it's who still is going to be playing quarterback for the Steelers? Mm. And what does this do about Aaron Rodgers? You know, does he ever decide and make a decision anytime soon here?
But when we look at that decision around George Pickens, obviously it means he's not going to be destined for Crow Park in a couple of weeks' time when the right. Steelers come to town. But is this a situation that rather than bring in an immense talent, they have tried to offload a guy who's volatile and a guy who seems in many ways to be uncoachable or certainly a challenge to manage?
And, you know, there's the business side of it too, Damien, which is he's in the final year of his rookie contract. And so that's basically saying we could get some stuff for him right now that we probably wouldn't be able to get for him in 7 months or at the end of next season when they wouldn't re-sign him, you know. And the Cowboys have already said they don't plan to re-sign him unless he just has some incredible season. You know, they'll probably let him test the free agent market. So, you know, it's that business side of things that has to come into it as well. Mm.
Is it not highly unusual that we don't know those fixtures yet in terms of who's going to come to Dublin, or are these things just such Goliaths that they're not going to care who the teams are because they know they'll sell it out and they have the vast wealth to be able to navigate those transatlantic logistics at short notice?
So the NFL, you know, you and I have talked about this in years past. It's the only league in America that like makes a whole day and a whole thing about announcing its schedule. And I believe that's coming up in about a week or two. Mm. So we'll know in pretty short notice. But they usually don't leak out of far in advance. I mean, even just announcing that the Steelers were going to be playing over there, you know, that's kind of a heads up to be like, look, if you want to go, start buying your tickets and, you know, getting your fares to travel overseas. That's really what more of that has to do than anything. But they typically don't get out ahead of things that far in advance.
Okay. So if we move to the NBA, the playoffs, we'll talk about some of the matches themselves in a minute. But Steph Curry injured. I found it very interesting to look at the narrative around this because he's going to miss the Warriors probably next three games as a result of a hamstring injury. And suddenly it seems to have ignited a massive debate about the stress that they inflict on players, which has been the same case every year. But it's only when the marquee player who gets bums on seats and gets TV audiences tuned in, gets injured, that the commercial world of the NBA seems to take the demands on their players somewhat more seriously than usual.
I would agree with that. You know, about 20 years ago, the playoffs in the first round, it was a best of five series. And I mean, you know, it was intense. I mean, you really had no margin for error. And they expanded those first rounds into seven-game series. And now the playoffs last a month and a half, plus the slog of the regular season. Plus, you know, every couple of years you've got an Olympics thing that's thrown in there. And, you know, that's when the debate starts to rage. I do think that we could be on the cusp in the next couple of years of maybe shortening the NBA season, Damien. Mm. But you've got to get the players' union and the owners all on the same page, because these salaries and contracts are written for 82-game regular seasons. And, you know, no one's going to give an inch. You know, the players don't want to give up money. The owners don't want to pay money for games not played. So I think there's a lot of work that would have to go into this. But yes, you're right. I mean, a guy like LeBron goes down, someone like Steph Curry goes down, especially in the playoffs. You know, it's just going to put a spotlight on the length of the season.
Yeah, because the thing that intrigued me from having been in Chicago earlier this year and to talk to people about, you know, the resale platforms and how cheap you can get tickets to certain Bulls games on, say, StubHub and other things. And it's more a case of there's such a saturation of games for the home fans that it's when the Warriors come to town or when it's certain away teams come to town, it becomes far more difficult to get tickets, or they're certainly more expensive, not because of a travelling support, but because the Cubs or the Bulls fans themselves will say, well, actually, I wouldn't mind seeing the Warriors when I can see the Bulls, you know, twice a week for whatever number of weeks of the year. So, like, it does feel like it's reached a tipping point of sorts.
No, I would agree. I mean, you know, the market, you know, by us, the New Orleans Pelicans, I mean, you know, perennially one of the, you know, worst teams in the league, unfortunately. And it's the same thing, you know. I mean, they're going to sell out when the Lakers are in town, the two times that the Lakers are in town, and, you know, when the Warriors are in town. But, you know, a Tuesday night game against Memphis, there's going to be 4,000 people in the building, you know. And so, I mean, that's a problem. Now, I mean, that's a problem for the NBA. They've already got the ticket, the TV money already paid for, so I don't know how much they really care about it. But I mean, if people are actively just avoiding your product in person, I don't necessarily think that's a good thing, right?
I agree with you 100%. And then, so in terms of how it's all shaping up, so you've got the Celtics, who are the current champions, are 2-0 down against the Knicks, so big question, can they turn that around? And I suppose, are the Thunder the team to really keep an eye on in terms of the early form or the early showing in these playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they looked phenomenal last night in their comeback win. You know, they won by 43 points. I think it was interesting to note, Damian, that this is the first time in the history of the NBA that when you've gotten into the, you know, conference semifinals, all four road teams won their games. So, I mean, you know, just think about that. I mean, that doesn't usually happen. I mean, in any sports, I mean, you know, the road team typically is at a disadvantage. You know, with regards to the Celtics in game one, they missed 45 three-pointers. I mean, you know, like, that is a ton. And they made 15, but they missed 45 more. So they went 15 of 60, you know. And, I mean, that's just terrible shooting percentage. They lost last night a tight one at the last second. They almost had a shot, but they got the ball stolen from them right in the last couple of seconds. I mean, look, you know, the Pacers have really outshot the Cavaliers in the other Eastern Conference semifinal game there. I mean, they made 50-something percent of their three-pointers in game one. They didn't do as well in game two, but Cleveland shot poorly in both of those games. And look, we'll see tonight in game two with the Timberwolves and the Warriors, how much impact does this Steph injury have? You've still got Jimmy Butler. You've still got Draymond Green. You've got a great veteran coach in Steve Kerr, but they know he's not going to be back for three games. I mean, they can, you know, bury their head in the sand and just wait for him to come back, or they can try to steal one and you know, try to extend it to where they can maybe have him for three games when he comes back from this hamstring injury. But, you know, Damien, those are injuries that are not just healed overnight. Those things linger.
Yeah. Listen, we'll leave it there from a sporting context. It's probably not the platform for us to start a big conversation about the place of the Catholic Church in American society and whether or not having an American Pope will maybe in some way pressurize the president to work towards regaining America's moral compass. Maybe we might leave that for another conversation somewhere else along the line. But it'd be interesting to see what Donald J. Trump's thought process is like as he sits in the Oval Office this evening, to suddenly think, could pressure come upon me by the most powerful man in the church, which is obviously a key electorate issue, or am I getting far too ahead of myself?
Yeah. Well, maybe a little bit, but I'm sure it'll be discussed. I'm sure he's going to get asked questions about it here very soon.
Okay. This is definitely going to be the wildest tangent that we've gone on in years. Chef, lovely to talk to you as always. Thanks so much for being with us. And we'll chat again next week. All going well. So that is Shep joining us from the States. And listen, you can't say we're not multifaceted and multi-layered across broadcasting, public service broadcasting at its finest. We've had rugby. We've had Josh Van der Fleer. We've had analysis of the new Pope. What else would you get? And to round it all up with his thoughts on Pope Leo XIV, we're going to be joined after the break by Keith Tracy. Stay with us.
This is 2FM Game On Soccer.
So you're welcome back to the programme. Keith Tracy's with me in studio. How are you?
I'm okay, Damien. How are you?
Only okay.
Only okay. The Arsenal. I'm proud of my team, but at the end of the day, we went out.
Well, listen, I was going to bring it. I was going to start on that and just get. Sometimes it's worse to get the bad news out of the
just
way.
Rip the Band-Aid off.
That's
yeah.
We're going to open the scab now live on the radio. Mikel Arteta's assertion that the best team in Europe have been knocked out of the Champions League. It's a bit excessive.
Yeah, I understand what he means by that. I mean, when you look back to the before they started the fourth leg, the Opta supercomputer did have Arsenal as the favourites to win the Champions League. Personally, I never went along with that. I didn't think that Arsenal would get past Real Madrid over two legs. The fact that, you know, PSG have nipped them too. And look, I do think there was a lot of sliding doors moments within the game. I wouldn't be the biggest fan of Donnarumma, but I thought he was absolutely excellent over the two legs. He made some... A brilliant save against Martinelli in the fourth leg. A brilliant save from Trossard. Rice missed a header like within the first 3 minutes. Martinelli had one that he should have done an awful lot better with. He made a wonderful save from Saka. A great save from Odegaard. And Arsenal defensively weren't quite as strong as they have been within the Premier League. And the amount of chances they gave PSG, you know, with Kvaratskhelia on one wing, Doué on the other, Barcola, Dembélé coming off the bench, I always felt that PSG had enough class to hit the back of the net. And with Gabriel out, I was never too confident. But like I said, this is Arsenal's second year back in the Champions League, and it's not. You probably go back 3-4 years ago where people are going, this Arsenal team's not good enough to be in the Champions League, and you know, so on and so forth. So I don't want to give it the whole small club mentality, happy with me lot, but Arsenal's a team that's going in the right direction, and I'm quietly happy.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, because the debate is now focused on Arteta, and it's another season without silverware in a league and in competitions where the level of competition is unlike anything that teams have dealt with over the years. And, you know, the debate now is, have Arsenal progressed or have they regressed under Arteta?
Well, again, like I don't think it's one or the other. I think it can be both. I think, you know, obviously, in my view, Arsenal have got better. They've got an awful lot better. We're in the semi-finals of the Champions League. I know second place in the Premier League is not sewn up just yet. But when you think about how good Liverpool are, how good PSG are,
and people
Barcelona,
ignore all this.
Inter...
Like, people talk about Arsenal, the points tally this. Like, and even, like, you know, you talk about Liverpool and people are going, listen, they won a lucky Premier League in COVID. Mm. And now they've won a lucky Premier League because Manchester City have dropped off. And it completely ignores the points tally and the performances and everything else that the team has done. So it's too simplistic to say, well, Arsenal have only got to the semi-finals of the Champions League. They've only about to finish second in the Premier League and they've gone backwards.
Yeah, I don't think Arsenal have gone backwards. I think it's extremely harsh to say Arsenal have gone backwards. I take the point that maybe Arsenal are becoming this nearly team. But look, when you look at the teams that are getting knocked out of, the teams that are rubbing shoulders with, Manchester City last year when they won the Premier League, they're going to go down as one of the best ever Premier League teams we've ever seen. Liverpool under Arnie Slot this season have been unbelievable, and I did not see that one coming. So I understand why Arsenal fans or pundits might be throwing a little bit of shade at Arsenal within the Premier League, saying the door was opening because Manchester City fell off a cliff. But Liverpool have been absolutely excellent, and we've been knocked out by a PSG team that for me are unbelievable. I know in the league phase of the Champions League they weren't firing on all cylinders, but I think they're unbelievable. Even that Inter team, the Barcelona team, I had Arsenal in and around as probably third strongest team within the semi-finals, and that was before Inter did so well against Barcelona.
But like two brilliant semi-finals, and it reminds you of how good this competition can be when it gets to this stage. Like, I don't know if that league phase has really got people, but like, you know, the Inter-Barca game, the two of them, like, you'd buy the DVD of those.
But that second game, I have that down as probably, if not the best ever game I've seen in the Champions League. It's right up there. And I know there's a whole load of Spurs fans that'll say the Spurs and Ajax game. I don't think I've seen anything like that since the Liverpool and AC Milan game back in 2005 when Milan were 3-0 up at half time and Liverpool managed to wrestle it back and win it on penalties. You were there for it?
I was there with my dad.
But there you go. I have that down as probably just up there with that. Yeah. I know one was a final and a semi-final, but I had no skin in the game, Inter Milan and Barcelona, but I was jumping around the sitting room like an absolute lunatic. When Acerbi put that in, I thought, for a man to have, you know, testicular cancer, come back from the brink of that sort of stuff and just be doing what he's doing at his age, it's really is inspired and stuff.
Yeah, and I think a reminder of just what it's like. So we've got the Europa League tonight. Spurs 3-1 up on Bodo Glimt in advance of their second leg. Man United 3-0 up ahead of facing Athletic Bilbao. Two formalities, or if you're Bilbao in particular, Are you saying to yourself, if we get stuck into United early,
yeah,
they could get nervy?
Out of the two games, I think the Manchester United one is a possession. I think I really like Atletico Bilbao when they're at full strength. I think they're a very, very dangerous team. The fact that Nico Williams and Inaki Williams hasn't travelled, Vivian got sent off in the fourth leg, so he won't be playing. You know, they're very, very under strength, and I thought they were very underwhelming in the fourth leg, and I also felt that if Atletico Bilbao were going to do anything in this tie, they have to win the home game. So I would imagine that with Casemiro, Fernandez, Hoyland all being rested on the weekend and Amad Diallo starting to come back to full fitness, that United team should have, you know, way too much. And some of the stats in United's favour are really, really good. United boast a 100% record in UEFA competitions when winning the fourth leg away from home. 20 out of 20.
Wow, that's, yeah.
It's heavy, isn't
it? For all that they're being criticised.
The game that I'll be going home to watch tonight is the Spurs game. And not because I'm an Arsenal fan and I'm hoping bad on Spurs, but going to an Astro pitch, I think, it's just a leveller. You can't move the ball as quickly as you want, and I know Spurs would have trained on the Astro yesterday at some point, but it's not the same when people start pressing you.
Is that when your game management comes into your mindset? That is the message from Ange Postecoglou over the course of the week: we have this buffer, let's kill this tie, or let's control. Like if it's pass the ball around between ourselves for 90 minutes, let's do whatever we need to do to eradicate stuff like that that's out of your control.
That's the one thing I would be urging Ange Postecoglou and Tottenham not to be doing is keeping the ball for keeping the ball's sake, passive possession as I would call it. When the sideways and backwards passes on an Astro, it just shapes the press from the opposition team. I expect Spurs to have too much for Bodo Glimt, but as I say, I do feel that an Astro pitch is a big, big leveller. And when you look at the Spurs away losses this season against Liverpool, only recently they lost 5-1. They've been turned over 4-2 to Wolves, 2-0 to Fulham, 1-0 to Alkmaar in this tournament. So the standard within the tournament hasn't been huge, but Spurs in the fourth leg restricted Bodo Glimt to an XG of 0.26. So Bodo will be saying, you know, we didn't really get going in that game. But from Bodo's point of view, they'd one shot on target and scored in Tottenham Stadium. So they will think if we can keep it tight and keep it really narrow, there'll be something that we might be able to get the fourth goal and put Spurs on the back foot.
Is it like Arsene Wenger has come out, and to be fair to him, he has been consistent in his criticism of the Europa League winner getting a Champions League place automatically straight into the league phase. Like Ange Postecoglou took real offence to this as if it was like an anti-Spurs thing.
Yeah.
But it's funny that like nobody's talking about Spurs ending the wait for a European trophy or Man United ending the wait for a trophy or Amarin bringing a trophy. It's all about Champions League qualification. Like you know where I'm coming from? It's this disproportionate focus on the prize isn't going to be silverware on the 21st of May. The prize is going to be a return to the Champions League where on form you would say both of these teams will struggle massively.
Yeah, look, I think it's, you know, I've said this out loud and I've had a little bit of a bite back from Spurs fans. Oh, it's easy for an Arsenal fan to say them type of things. But when you look at the Premier League as a standalone for Spurs, it has been embarrassing. It's a really, really poor turnout down the wrong end of the table. And Manchester United the same. I think the two difference between the managers is Ruben Amorim is coming out and saying that we could be the worst ever Premier League team to win a European trophy. I think that's the reality of it. And what Arsene Wenger is saying, I understand what he's saying about it, but in this instance, it's Spurs and Manchester United that might pick up a European trophy or Champions League qualification seems to be the real prize. But you know, a couple of years down the line, it could be a Brentford, it could be a West Ham, or a so-called lower team that gets these type of opportunities. I think it leaves a little bit of a sour taste in the mouth because these are two giants of English football that have been nowhere near their best. And just the Spurs have a win rate in the European competition of 62%. In the Premier League, they're down to 31%. So they're literally twice as good in Europe than they have been in the Premier League.
Is there a catch-22 situation here for Daniel Levy and Spurs? Like, I think there's an inevitability that Postecoglou will leave during the summer. But are you back into an Erik ten Hag situation of he wins a major trophy and how difficult it is to get rid of him? Or, like, his body language, even, like, he's so abrasive in his media of late.
Yeah.
And it is almost a case of he knows himself, I've got 3 games left here, whatever it is, 4 games left between the Premier League and Europe, and I'm out the gap.
Yeah, well, I, again, when you look at them in the Premier League, and the Premier League is the bread and butter, and I know Spurs fans might say, look, as long as he qualifies for the Champions League, we don't really care, but it's been so underwhelming, and the basic mistakes within the Premier League have been so, so poor. So it's underwhelming. I think they will get better, but when Ange comes out and he's starting to say, you know, set pieces, this defensively, we're not really too bothered, and out of possession, they don't look like a very well coached team, and that's something that will always come back to get you when you're playing lower opposition within your European competition. I mean, I don't want to take any sort of kudos away from Spurs for getting this far, but Eintracht Frankfurt, AZ Alkmaar, Elfsborg, Rangers, AZ Roma, these are not the European heavyweights that they used to be, you know.
And it could go terribly wrong when you get back into the Champions League. You've got the United team, I think, do you?
I've got the United team here, yeah. So it's going to be Onana in goal, Victor Lindelof, Harry Maguire, Lenny Yoro as the three centre halves, Mazraoui as the right wing back, Patrick Dorgu as the left wing back, Ugarte and Casemiro in the middle, Bruno Fernandes, Garnacho and Hoyland up front. So as strong as United could be.
Yeah, Spurs, Vicario in goal, Porro, Van de Ven, Romero, Doggy across the back, Kulusevski, Betancourt, Bissouma across midfield, and Johnson, Solanke and Richarlison. So like seven changes from the weekend. So, you know, both managers have obviously rested players at the weekend to go all in for this. Chelsea in the Conference League semi-finals, 4-1 up against Djurgårdens. That's an inevitability. And like Real Betis Fiorentina, 2-1 Betis leads in the first leg. There's a fair bit of competition in that now to roll on and win that. And again, Maresca, another manager who I think has done quite a good job with like 850 first team players that he's been lumbered with. But again, doesn't seem to have endeared himself at all.
No, look, a lot of people used words with Enzo Maresca at the start of his Chelsea reign as heavy-handed, the way he was dealing with people. But honestly, I've been in dressing rooms where you're not quite sure if the manager fancies you or not, and you feel like you're being led along for whatever reason. You know, if he gets injured, we might need Keats, so we won't burn that bridge. He's gone in and told people where they stand. And as a player, you might not like it. You might think, oh, well, I'm better than X, Y, or Z, but at least the manager's told you the truth on where you stand. And yeah, I think the Chelsea dressing room is starting to push in the right direction. All sorts of talent in there. Just need to be a little bit more solid, and you know, going forward, they're excellent. But I think we say that about a lot of the modern Premier League teams. Brilliant going forward, but a little bit leaky.
Tomorrow night in the League of Ireland, the men's Premier Division, Derry City at home to St Pat's, Shamrock Rovers, Sligo Rovers, Drogheda against Cork City, Galway United. No, I'm gone wrong altogether, haven't I? No, they're the results. Oh, jeez, Keith, I'm giving you the results from Monday. That'll tell you where my head is at. Cork City against Derry, Shells against Pats, Waterford against Galway, Rovers against Drogheda, Sligo against Bows then on Saturday. It's massively compelling to look at Drogheda on top with 24 points, Bows in fifth on 21 points, like Galway 20 points. Like, it's so close. Is that a sign of brilliant competitiveness or a lack of teams gelling and hitting their straps and getting their momentum early on?
I think it's a bit of both. I think a lot of teams within the League of Ireland have got stronger. Obviously, Drogheda sitting at the top of the table. Shamrock Rovers still very, very strong. Pats extremely strong going forward. Bows are up and down like a yo-yo. 1 minute Alan Reynolds is, you know, getting all the plaudits in the world. The next they're calling for him to be sacked. And, you know, Galway have no European competition this year, so you'd imagine that they will sustain, I wouldn't say a title challenge, but at least a race for Europe. And it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, from 8th place up, Waterford are on 18 points, Drogheda are on 24. It's still an 8, you know, we're no closer to knowing who's going to win this league. And I think it's brilliant. I've been listening to a lot to Kevin Doherty, the Drogheda manager, and they've been held to this champions, you know, sort of form. And when they drop a point against Sligo, they draw it against Sligo, people are saying it's a really bad draw for Drogheda. Drogheda's remit is to stay in the league.
But come here, like, I was at the Pats game on the opening night of the season, and like Kevin, I love Kevin because he wears his heart in his sleeve, and he'll call you out on stuff. And like, he was that night, you know, he knew everyone who'd written them off in every preview. He knew everyone who said they were going to finish 10th in a 10 team league or 9th in a 10 team league. And like, we've kind of losing the run of ourselves now that here we are. How many number of games are we into the season at this stage? Like, so we're like just over a third of the way through the season. Like, where we're suddenly saying, oh, well, Jesus, like, these are champions. And, you know, like, the standards are, it, you know, listen, maybe that's a little bit about how we talk about things. To finish, I always, you're a tremendous guest to give us insights into the life of the professional sports person. So Mikel Arteta last night revealed that, like, fellas were crying in the dressing room after the result and being knocked out of Europe. So my question for you, Keith Tracy, is on how many occasions did you cry in a dressing room over the course of your career, and what would you have led you to such an emotional outburst?
I don't think I've ever cried because of the result of a game. There's been I told this story not so long ago, but when Crystal Palace played Preston, we had to go and win, and Darren Unsworth, sorry, I forget his first name, the Everton, David Unsworth.
David.
He was the caretaker manager at the time. And long story short, I sort of went into a dribble into the box. Paddy McCarthy takes me down for a penalty. I get booked for diving, although it wasn't diving. Okay. Paddy McCarthy actually asked the referee not to send them off because, you know, he just said, give a penalty, don't send me off.
So he knew.
Referee books me for diving. From the free kick that Crystal Palace have won, they've pumped it into our box, a flick on, and he beat us 1-0 from that one. And yeah, we got the laptop out, we showed the referee, and the referee was telling me and Paddy McCarthy at the same time that it's still not a penalty, and me and Paddy McCarthy are telling them it was a penalty.
Isn't it great in this world of toxic masculinity that fellas can just show their emotions and cry in a dressing room?
Of course it is. Well, I've never been moved to tears. I've been extremely annoyed and extremely sad, and I would go and sit in a dark room for hours. I'd go missing for a little while, but never quite been moved to tears.
Well, listen, it's been a great pleasure to chat to you in our padded dark room. You know, what do you do for a living? I sit in a padded room speaking to myself.
It's exactly what I need after Arsenal.
It's I sit in a dark room talking to myself in the faint hope that someone somewhere is listening. So anyway, Keith, thanks so much for being with us.
Cheers,
as always, that brings the programme to a conclusion. Laura Lee Davies was our broadcast coordinator. The programme produced by Andrew O'Connor. Bet is here with the new music show. Jenny's here after 9. Dan's here after 11. From all of us here, till we chat again, good night.
This is 2FM.